I'm going to let them go ahead and hand that out. Last week, we talked about Hezekiah's Passover. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 30, it describes that Hezekiah was a good king, wasn't he? And he came along and he started doing reformation because the two southern tribes of Judah had forgotten the Lord and hadn't taken Passover as the command of Moses, that you do the Passover the 14th day of the first month of every year. Hezekiah comes in after his father was a wicked, bad king, and they had all types of idolatry going on. And so Hezekiah came in to clean up the church. But the problem was, by the time he got, when he became king, was in the first month, but it took him 16 days to clean out the temple. So now it's the first month, the 16th day, and so they're past the deadline of what the law demanded that they take the Passover. Never mind that they hadn't taken the Passover for years. And so Hezekiah decides, you know what, we're going to go ahead and have Passover the second month on the 14th day. So he's a month late. Now, that goes contrary to everything that Scripture says at that point of the law. And the law, as you and I know, if you followed the law, you were blessed. If you did not follow the law, you were cursed. Some of you know that. And so Hezekiah took this risk, this huge risk of being cursed by the Lord, because now they're partaking in the Passover, not on the first month, on the 14th day, but on the second month. So he's a month late, but the Bible lets us know that Hezekiah prayed and the Lord blessed it. He was gracious to the people and they had a great celebration. The Lord blessed them so much so that one of the mandates or the rules is that this whole week you didn't eat unleavened bread, which is kind of where we get our communion from Passover. And you do that for 1 week and you celebrate the Lord, the Lord's deliverance, the Lord's deliverance from Egyptian bondage. And that's part of the Passover meal. The people were having such a good time that not only did they go for 1 week, but they said, hey, let's celebrate for another week. And when they celebrated for another week, then it's like, now not only are they a month late, but they thought, let's celebrate for a lot longer. That's not according to the law. This time the people pray and the Lord blessed them. And so the reason we talk about that is because there's a couple things. That one that I want to remind you is heart intent takes precedence over exactness of procedure. That Hezekiah was trying to honor the Lord, wasn't he? He was trying to reinstitute a sacred ceremony that the Israelites had forgotten. And this whole idea was this gracious renewal of their relationship with God is more important than the particulars of the Passover. That's what we all have to remember. That the idea is he's trying his very best to seek the Lord, to honor the Lord, and to get the people to honor the Lord more than the particulars. And the Lord blessed it. This is amazing, especially for Old Testament. We all have moments, we said, when we don't bring, as you know, our A game. There's times, there's seasons where we aren't as close to the Lord as we'd like to be. There's moments when we don't just bring our spiritual A game all the time, is there? There's times when our hearts are truly intent, when we try to honor the Lord, and when we do that, His grace is available. When our hearts are truly intent on trying to honor the Lord, His grace is available. Isn't that good news? That the Bible lets you and I know that man looks on the outward appearance when they're talking about having a new king, and Samuel is keep going, well, surely this one, he's tall and handsome and good looking, and the Lord lets him know, God doesn't look on the outward appearance, God looks on the heart. And so this idea is to make sure that we try to keep our hearts right with the Lord beyond everything else going around us, right? So, as a result, last week I asked you guys to fast and pray and to seek the Lord for three things. Our future vision, because we're talking about that in this Is Us series. For our leadership, because we have to make big decisions. And for our hearts, because man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks at our... A couple of you know that, right? Where does God look? Yes. That's the thing that we have to keep before the Lord. And so, when our hearts are truly intent, trying to honor the Lord, His grace is available. And so we really are looking, as we look at us, let's turn our hearts to the Lord. Let's ask, God, will you restore? Will you have mercy? Will you give us grace? Aren't we all really trying to say to the Lord, we genuinely, intently want to follow you? That's why we're here, even in the midst of the snow. Is this true of us? Has this been historically true of our church, that we really have tried to seek the Lord, to try to honor the Lord with our intents and with our hearts? Has that changed? No? Even what John said was a really nice compliment, but he recognized the go. Man, all those people showing up yesterday, serving on Friday night, our hearts are trying to serve and honor the Lord. That's the most important thing about church. So today we want to talk more about Hezekiah's reform, because Hezekiah not only did he changed, the good news was he was trying to start this new worship experience that the Israelites had laden for a long, long time. And so he's trying to honor the Lord by reinstituting the Passover and getting rid of the idolatry. But before we do that, I want to, if you would, turn into the book of Numbers, chapter 21, because we want to get a backdrop of this story of some more of Hezekiah's reform. Numbers 21, Numbers is telling us about, it's similar to the book of Exodus, where the people of Israel have been escaped from Egyptian bondage, which is the reason they celebrate Passover, for the Passover lamb, the night the death angel came and wiped out the firstborn, and the Israelites got out of Egyptian slavery after 430 years. And so now, Numbers is the story of them traveling across the wilderness. And Numbers 21, verse 1 says this: when the Canaanite king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming along the road to Etharim, he attacked the Israelites and captured some of them. Then Israel made this vow to the Lord: if you will deliver these people into our hands, we will totally destroy their cities. The Lord listened to Israel's plea and gave the Canaanites over to them. They completely destroyed them and their towns, so the place was named Hormah. They traveled from Mount Or along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way, and they spoke against God and against Moses and said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no bread, there is no water, and we detest this miserable food. This sounds like kids on a long road trip, huh? I'm thirsty. I'm hungry. I have to go to the bathroom. When are we going to get there? Right? But this is more severe, because this is the people of God now saying, Lord, you tricked us. You just brought us out in the desert to let us die. We don't have any food, we don't have any water, and we're fussing. Have these people seen miracles? Have they seen the Lord's deliverance over and over again? And they keep forgetting how God has been with them in the past, how He's delivered, how He's restored, how He's healed, how He's made new. And so now this, they just get done defeating this group of people that had attacked them, and they said, Lord, if you give them in our hands, we'll wipe them out. And they did, and the Lord blessed them. Once again, right on the heels of the Lord blessing and giving victory. There's no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food. You know what they're detesting? The manna that the Lord has given to them. Every day they don't have to go out and make their own food. They get food from heaven. And they're just fussing about that. Verse 8 or 6 says, then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, we sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us. So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord took it very serious, didn't he? That these people were grumbling and complaining. He didn't want to put up with it. And so he sent snakes. It's a brutal picture, isn't it? I don't like snakes to begin with. But imagine all these snakes come around biting people and they're dying, and they go, oh, our bad, Lord, forgive us. And so Moses prayed for them. Then the Lord said to Moses, make a snake and put it up on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live. So Moses made a bronze snake and put it up on a pole, and then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived. This is kind of a strange story, isn't it? That first of all, they grumble and complain after they've been set free from Egyptian bondage. They're getting bread from heaven and they fuss on the road. God's given them victory and they complain about how it's all going. And so snakes come in, and then Moses prays and the Lord answers him and says, well, make a bronze snake, put it on a pole, and anyone who looks at it lives. Now, is that very theological? I don't know. But sometimes God just says, I want you to do the silliest thing. We think of communion. Sometimes we do it in silence. Sometimes we take the bread and the fruit of the vine in memorial and symbol. When they did the Passover, he said, I want you to stand up, have your coat tucked in, your belt on, put your walking shoes on and take your staff in your hand and eat this hurriedly. Not like we do Thanksgiving where we sit down, have turkey. We have our own traditions, our own symbolisms, and all those things. But God goes, I want you to sometimes do this thing that doesn't make sense. And I want you to do this. And when you look at it, you will live as a sign of obedience. Jesus even preached about it later on when he says, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up on a tree. Making reference to this idea that when you look to this, this is your salvation. Jesus is the salvation on the cross, isn't he? This was their salvation. When you looked at the snake, you lived. Years pass. People forgot about the Exodus. People forgot to honor the Lord. Turn over, if you would, please, to 2 Kings chapter 18. And this is Hezekiah doing some more reform. Last week we talked about him reforming and reinstituting the Passover. This week, this is a different thing. 2 Kings 18 verse 1 says this. In the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. His mother's name was Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as the father David had done. The text is letting you and I know very clearly, which is very important, just like it did last week, even though for the purist of the law would think automatically that, man, Hezekiah's being rebellious. He's gone off his rocker. He's instituting the Passover a month late. That's why the text lets us know in the narrative that Hezekiah was righteous and pure before the Lord. It's also setting us up at the reader to go, we want you to know he was blessed of the Lord and he's righteous and he's doing it right. And this, listen what he does. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah pole. So he's getting rid of all the idolatry, which is cool. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made. For up to that time, the Israelites had been burning incense to it. It was called Nehushtan, which means that bronze thing. Hezekiah trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. There was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before him or after him. He held fast to the Lord and did not stop following him. He kept the commands the Lord had given Moses. Sandwiched between Hezekiah did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. There was no other king like him. No other king is righteous. What'd he do to Moses' bronze snake? He pulled it down and he smashed it into pieces. In Numbers, if the people that were walking around in Numbers saw that, I think they would have revolted, don't you? Because when you look to the bronze snake in the time of Moses, you would live. It was life-giving. It was sacred. It was a holy thing that the Lord made holy. It's just a bronze snake on a pole. You ever seen a bronze snake on a pole before?
No.
I think you have. Do we have pictures? See on the front of that ambulance? There's this blue thing, and the side of that, there's a snake and a pole. That's interesting, huh? When I think of health and healing, American Medical Association, their symbol is a snake on a pole. When I think of healing, I don't necessarily think of snakes, do you? Now, over time in different cultures, people have said, well, that's a part of different goddesses from the Roman era. And so there's lots of debate about that. But as Christians, we also have our snake on the pole. That snakes and on a pole became a sign and a symbol of healing. And medics, I was on the way here this morning, and one of the Cherokee County ambulances was on the side, and it also has this. That this has been a symbol of healing for all these years. There's this sacredness to it, or others go, well, it's from this Greek goddess that also did that. I don't know. There's lots of debate. But as Christians, I think that's kind of cool. Maybe you'll look at it differently now. But nevertheless, Hezekiah destroys the bronze snake that Moses had made. Why? Because it had become an object of idolatry. People were worshiping it, it says. People were burning incense to it. That's one of the things when I was in India that they do is anytime, whether it be a peacock or an elephant, you come and you make a little food sacrifice and you put some oranges and some sliced up bananas and some little grain and you put it there and you give it to the Lord and then you burn it up and then you burn incense to make a fragrant aroma so the God will be pleased. Now, they're going, let's please. These people were so enamored with idolatry that they're worshiping all kinds of gods. And now they remember the story. Oh, you look at the snake and you live. Let's worship the snake. Let's worship the bronze thing. That's what they called it. Nehushtan. Sometimes we forget, huh? It once pointed to God. Now it pointed to itself. The idea, it wasn't in the snake that healed you. The idea was the obedience and the faith to say, God said, look at this, so I'm going to do it. And it pointed to the Lord, but there it twisted the meaning over time. And the text lets you and I know that the Lord was pleased with Hezekiah, that which once was sacred is no longer sacred. When it stops pointing to the Lord and it starts pointing to itself, it loses its holiness, its separateness, its sacredness. Over time, things can change and mean something different, can't they? I think of language. Language, cultures, culture and time changes language, doesn't it? Don't believe me? Think about this word, bad. Now think of bad just for a moment, right? Okay, what does bad mean? So, some of it's context, isn't it? Right? In basketball, that guy's a bad basketball player. Tone and inflection. That guy's a bad basketball player. What does that mean? It means he's good, which is so weird. Right? Or sick. Aaron is sick today. Aaron was a really sick soccer player. Do you know that Aaron was an All-American in college? Every tournament that he was ever in was always MVP. It's his short little legs that makes him run really fast. But he was an All-American. And so when I say Aaron was a sick soccer player, what am I saying? Dude's an All-American. He's really good. But when I say he's sick today, he's staying home, not because he's really good. Sometimes it's context. Sometimes our culture has shifted, huh? When I say, do you like Coke? Be careful. Want some Coke? It depends on if I'm in the street corner, right? Listen, look at this phrase. The drug addicts were in the corner of the alley sitting down with some Coke and nachos. Which is it? You could interpret it both ways because maybe they got the munchies or maybe they're snorting up, right? Not with nachos because those are crunchy. And make your nose yellow. Or what about this one? Those are hot chicks. If you're 17, it might be different than if you're a farmer. I'm just saying. Right? Now, no offense, but what does gay really mean? Deck the halls with boughs of holly, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Tis the season to be jolly, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Don we now our gay apparel, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Troll the ancient Yuletide carol. What does troll the carol mean anyway? Now, is gay apparel mean homosexual apparel? Kookaburra sits in the old gum tree, merry, merry king of the bush is he. Laugh, kookaburra, laugh, kookaburra, gay your life must be. Gay means lighthearted and carefree. Webster defined it that way in 1978 when I graduated. You know what defines it now? Lighthearted and carefree or homosexual. Language has changed, huh? When was a Coke a Coke? It's different now. In language, meaning gets altered over time. Cultural and social contracts define meaning. We agree on certain things mean certain things, don't we? Two farmers looking at the corn crop this year, or you know, or years past when it's a time of drought, and when a farmer says, that's a bad corn crop, what does he mean? We know. That's not very good. It's not going to have very good harvest or very high yield. But two guys in the inner city watching a really good basketball player go, man, that guy's a bad basketball player. We know culturally that means now bad means good. So culture and context also determine meaning. It's a social contract. We all agree that certain things have meaning. Years ago, gay meant lighthearted. Today, if you say there's kids innocent and carefree enjoying themselves, you wouldn't say, those kids are being gay. You can't say that anymore. Because that today, that just wouldn't be proper. Flintstones, meet the Flintstones. They're the modern-day Stone Age family. From the town of Bedrock, they're a page right out of history. When you're with the Flintstones, have a yabba-dabba-doo time, a dabba-doo time. We'll have a gay old time. I don't think Fred and Barney were gay. Wilma and Betty had a say, right? I mean, they're not depicted that, but see how it's changed over time? We used to think that was innocent and fun, and I loved the Flintstones. Language and meanings change over time as society changes, but names also change over time. Genesis chapter 2, God said, your name is man, which means Adam. And then who named the animals? Adam. He said, you're a giraffe because you're tall. I don't know. You're an elephant because you're plumpy. You know, all that. Who named Eve? Adam. When did he name Eve? What did God call Eve? Woman. Her name got changed after the fall when the curse said, now your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. To name something has authority over it. It's an identifier. It's a descriptor. Genesis 4, the parents Adam and Eve named Cain, means brought forth. Genesis 12 says that Abram was his name and Sarai. That was their name. Then in Genesis 17, God said, now you will be Abraham, which means the father of many. And you will be Sarah. And Abraham in Genesis 7, don't forget that Sarah laughed in Genesis 18, but in Genesis 17, Abraham also laughed. And the Lord renamed Abraham. And Abraham laughed. He goes, okay, you don't get to name your child. I'll name him. And Isaac means he laughed. In Genesis 32. Or Genesis 25, there's two twins born to Rebecca. Isaac and Rebecca had two twins. One was named Esau. You know what Esau meant? Hairy. And then they later on called him Edom because he was red. So he's red and hairy. And Edom means red. Hairy, red one. And Jacob means deceiver, grasper of the heel. In those days, the name was an identifier. It was a descriptor. It was the describer of who that person was. And so when God changed their name, he goes, you're going to become something very different. I'm going to change your name. In Genesis 32, Jacob, this deceiver, this heel grasper, became Israel. And that's where we get the 12 sons or the 12 tribes of Israel, because Israel means he struggles with God. And boy, doesn't it still. But it's also blessed by the Lord. In your bulletins, there's a story even in the New Testament. Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Jesus answered, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Peter's name used to be Simon. And God goes, we're going to change that, and we're going to call you Cephas, the stone, the rock. I'm going to build my church. Acts 9, remember the story of a guy named Saul? Saul was the guy going around persecuting the church, wasn't he? God grabbed him in chapter 9 and says, you're on my team now. And he converted him, became a devout follower of God. And by Acts 13, he changed his name to Paul. Saul becomes Paul, Simon becomes Peter, Abram becomes Abraham. Their name has to change because it's the appropriate descriptor of who they really are. To name something was to proclaim authority, covering, belonging to it. That's why the Lord said, Peter, we're going to make this different. Maybe you may be parts of these clubs, but have you ever said, I'm an elk? Maybe you belong to an elk's lodge, so you call yourself an elk. Or, I used to be a lion, now I'm just a standing. I know, that was terrible. I used to be a part of the Lions Club, and so I was a lion. Or, anybody ever sell Mary Kay? Maybe you're a Mary Kayer. Or maybe you're a ram, or a bulldog, or a lion, or a titan. Why? Those are descriptors of your home teams, your symbols that you associate with, right? This past March, my daughter, my very own child, had the audacity to change her name. Ugh. She went from Mackenzie Davis to McKinney Fetner. What's a Fetner anyway? Why did she change her name? Because she married a guy and she's no longer under my spiritual authority. I can't tell her what to do. She's to become one with Mikey Fetner. She's supposed to become a Fetner. Authority, covering, belonging. Her allegiance changed in a moment when we call it performative speech acts. When the Lord says, let there be light. Boom, there's light. When he says, you're no longer Abram, you're Abraham. Boom, you change and become somebody different. I now pronounce you husband and wife. Now you're Mikey and Mackenzie Fetner. And in that moment, did she change? Yes and no. She still has my DNA. She still has her same IQ, which may be positive or negative, depends on how Mikey looks at it. Same personality. But is she different? Yes. Her allegiance is no longer to me first. Her allegiance is to leave and cleave to her first. Mikey's did too. And now they're one. They're, even for a period of time, Mackenzie, I think she was joking, but a little bit serious, Dad, can I keep my last name? No. As much as I'd like you to, you cannot. You're a Fetner now. You go and be a Fetner. Because it means something. It meant something to Mikey, I'm sure. And she's now to be different and operate differently. So let's review. What once was something, what once was sacred isn't always sacred. Only God is sacred all the time and forever, huh? What once was sacred, like the bronze snake, isn't always sacred. When it stops pointing to the Lord and starts pointing to itself, it loses its sacredness. God changes names, doesn't he? He changes names to more accurately describe who people are. And a name also declares something about authority and allegiance. When he says, Saul, you're with me. You're no longer with the Pharisees, you're with the Christians. And he became Paul. Let's review our church history. On March 2nd, 1867, we were called Spring River Monthly Meeting. That was our first name. We became Spring River Friends Church after that. We were that for 67 years. In 1934, we became Riverton Friends Church. We've been that for 84 years, excuse me. Riverton used to be called Vark. How many remember that? Vark? Aren't you glad we didn't keep the name Vark? You know what our basketball team would be? We'd be the Vark Aardvarks. That's the only thing I can think of that goes with Vark. So thank goodness we're at least the Riverton Rams, right? Because otherwise, we'd be going, go Aardvarks, go. We dodged that one, so thank you, whoever changed that. In 2008, we moved out from underneath the Friends denomination, both for their benefit and our benefit. We as elders at that time decided to keep the name. We were no longer under the Friends Church authority. We no longer had sole allegiance to them, and we no longer belonged as a Friends Church. Now as elders, we decided to no longer keep the name Friends. That we go, that is not an accurate descriptor of who we are. It doesn't mean what it used to mean to us. We are not a Friends Church. We are not under their authority. Mackenzie is not a Davis. And Mackenzie, you cannot keep your name. You become a Fetner. Imagine if McDonald's, a company said, we're going to make square hamburgers and have Frosties instead of shakes. But we just want to keep the golden arches because we like it. That wouldn't be appropriate, really, would it? People say, well, we are friendly. Well, we don't call ourselves Riverton Friendly Church. We also baptize, and we don't call ourselves Riverton Baptist. Where to from here? We don't know 100%, but what the elders have felt led to do is that we're going to take the name Friends out of our name. So we're going to have a process. Why change the name? Well, all the reasons we've mentioned, we've been talking about. But number one, we want to be a people of integrity. We owe something not just to our history, but also to Mid-America Yearly Meeting. Listen to a letter we received from them in 2008. It's been 10 years. We received this letter from Mid-America Yearly Meeting when we talked about our name change. Church name. Item number two, church name. Riverton Friends Church has held that name since 1934 when it was changed from Spring River Monthly Meeting of Friends. Since the church has decided to separate it from Evangelical Friends Church Mid-America Yearly Meeting, some would see an ethical dilemma in holding on to the name of Friends. So they highlight to go, you might have ethical issues here. However, there is no legal trademark or patent involved with the name Friends. So we will not request that the church change its name at this time, and hope that by retaining it, the church at some point in the future will see fit to renew its relationship with the Evangelical Friends Church in Mid-America Yearly Meeting. You get what they're saying? They're saying, hey, we're giving you a pass that we care about you. Ethically, if you keep it, it's a dilemma. But we can't legally make you change your name. But we want you to keep the name in hopes that someday you will come back and be a part of our conference, our yearly meeting. What's 10 years? And we love our brothers and sisters there. I had no idea, by the way, my parents are going to be here, and they're part of Evangelical Friends Church Mid-America Yearly Meeting. So this is a little awkward. Pray for my lunch. Hi. But we must change our name to more accurately and appropriately declare who we are. So, number one, for integrity, when they say it's an ethical dilemma, but in the chance that you might come back, we'll let you slide. But we haven't done that for 10 years and we're not intending to. That'd be inappropriate to continue to say, we're going to call ourselves what you are when we're not apart. We're not under your authority. We don't operate under your authority. And ethically, I think it's an issue of integrity. Now, 10 years ago when the elders, we wrestled with that as we do today. And we decided, let's keep our name. I'm 100% convinced the elders and deacons have always tried to do the right thing, honor the Lord. And so, yes, I'm a part of that. So that's what we decided. And maybe, because maybe we'd have gone back. But we haven't. So, one is integrity. And number two, it does not accurately express who we are as a body of believers. We want our name to reflect who we are as a church. So let me describe the process. We are doing the process kind of right now. We're doing the process like we always have. Any decisions made from our church, spiritually, start with the elders. Financial matters, start with deacons. Elders have no say of finances. They don't vote on our salaries, or they don't have a consensus or any of that. The elders, then we go to the deacons. We've gone to the deacons, and they say, hey, that's on you. And we've talked about that, and so all hearts are clear there. Then we go to the servant leaders. We have a group of leadership. The people are behind the scenes leading all the service ministries, and we go to them. And then we come to you as a congregation. That's what we're doing right now. We've done that for 23 years. This is what we're still doing. And then so today, part of when we talk about let us us, what are the accurate descriptors? You've been describing us. You go, this is us. This is who we are. And you can still do that because you can go out and get more. This is us, and you can do more descriptors. In your bulletin is also a website. It says office@rivertonfriends.com. If you want to write more descriptors to say, hey, I think we are this, then you can email that to Aline, and she'll get that. And we're going to compile those and talk about those next week. And so we go to the congregation, and after the congregation, we're going to go, and everybody gets a say. This is the most say you've ever had about any decision we've ever made. Usually we just, elders make a decision, and the deacons, and then we announce it on Sunday. Like when we said, hey, we're going to no longer be a part of Mid-America Yearly Meeting. We just came and told you on a Sunday. Now, though, at least we're giving you, we want you have some input because this is us. We want to know what people say. What are the appropriate descriptors of who we are? And then it's going to go back to the servant leadership. So today's the 7th. Or 14th, excuse me. On the 21st, we're going to talk about this again. Servant leadership. And then on the 24th, it's going to go back to the elders and deacons. And then it's going to end up where it started with the elders. And on the 24th, we'll make the final say. And then on January 28th, 2018, we will reveal our new name. That's the process. 1 Timothy chapter 5 says this. The elders who direct the affairs of the church well are worthy of double honor. Especially those whose work is preaching and teaching. For the scripture says, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out grain, and the worker deserves his wages. Do not entertain an accusation against an elder unless it is brought by two or three witnesses. But those elders who are sinning, you ought to reprove before everyone so that the others may take warning. There's a part where it says, okay, elders get double warning, so they get double say. James also reminds us of a couple other things. That's the good news for elders. This is the bad news. Not many of you should become teachers, my fellow believers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. There's honor, but there's also weight to go. Every elder recognizes, going, I get judged twice as much as you all. All you have to do is go, cool. That's on your head. We don't have to worry about it. Hebrews does remind us of this, though. Hebrews 13:17, have confidence in your leaders and submit to their authority because they keep watch over you as those who must give an account. Do this so that their work will be a joy, not a burden, for that would be of no benefit to you. Elders are required to seek the Lord, just as Hezekiah. They can only say, we are trying. I can tell you with all my heart, for the last 23 years that I've been here, and I'm sure beyond, the elders have always, and the deacons have always said, let's try to honor the Lord and honor the people. That's never changed, and that's still not going to change. The only thing ultimately that's going to change is the word friends. We don't know what it's going to be. When people say, oh, you got a name, I'm sure you... I don't. I wanted to start today. I haven't even prayed about a name. But I want to start today because I want to see what we have to say. And then when we all say, what the majority comes is going to kind of rise and say, these are the appropriate descriptors of who we are. And so that's where we're at. So we want you to have a voice of words or words that are in your mind that describe who we are as a body of Christ. Next week, when we come back on the 21st, we will share what you have all said. And then we'll go to those who serve and ask them to narrow that list to the top 10. And then from that, the deacon and elders will narrow it down to the top 5, and then we'll be up to the elders for the final say. But everyone gets a say, and so you can submit as many descriptors as you want between now and next week, and we'll even talk about that. We'll reveal our new name. We will celebrate what God has done, and we will trust in the ways we believe that God is leading us. You know, over the last few months, we've been talking about This Is Us, and we're like, we're changing. We've had a safety team, and we're changing how we try to keep the kids safe. We're going to have a different key system and a video monitoring system to keep us safe. Our Wednesday nights, we've added all these new classes to help people. Don't forget, we've started the ministry called Refresh, which is an initiative to stop generational poverty here in Cherokee County. And last, even Wednesday, we just had this explosion. We had worship in here, by the way, from 6:30 to 7, and we're going to go to 6:30 to 5 till 7, so the classes can start on time. But it was awesome. We had a great week, and our children's ministry is going to be remodeling and doing some things to help our kids. We have a lot of vision for what God has for us. The only thing that's really changing is that we're a church that's used to change. We change stuff all the time, don't we? And so these classes that are new, we've done classes for a long time. We're just doing some different classes. We're still going to have the meal. We're going to have the same service. We're going to have all the same people. When you think about it, look around. This is us. We belong to each other. Hannah even said it. We didn't choreograph this, did we, Hannah? It was like, you belong to each other. We're a part of this community. We're bigger than our name. We're the people of God that have decided and are called to worship together here. This is us. This is a building. But this is us. Last week I asked you to fast and pray for our vision, for our leadership, and for all of our hearts. I hope you did. I hope that was meaningful. I hope it was challenging. I hope you met with the Lord during that time. I want to ask you to continue to do that. This isn't easy for some. Some have been here for a long, long time and walked with the Lord and gone, this is our name. That doesn't change who they are. That doesn't change who we are. It doesn't change that we love and care for each other. Let's be sensitive. Let's be caring. Let's be gracious. Let's be the body of Christ, and we'll walk through this together. Let's stand and pray.